From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
NVIDIA is off and flying this year. Ian King is U.S. semiconductor and networking reporter at Bloomberg News. He joins us on Zoom from San Francisco. Ian, NVIDIA is up another 26% today. It's up about 164% so far this year. It's the number one performer in the S&P 500 this year. We talk about it a lot, especially when it comes to AI. Is the euphoria over NVIDIA and its connection to AI justified?
There are a couple of ways to look at this. Obviously, we've had conversations on this over the last few days. And, you know, the big question was, is anybody actually making money out of AI? We're talking about it. Is anybody making money out of it? Yesterday's announcement showed that this company really is. Valuations, that's another question, right? We're looking at, what, 180 times current earnings? You can decide whether that represents a value for money or not, but they are putting up numbers that justify some of the hype. That's certainly true.
Yeah, so the forward PE is 54-55, which, you know, for a normal company would still be a very rich valuation. But it's yesterday at this time, it was like 65. So the E has really come up in terms of, you know, what analysts expect. I heard a great stat yesterday, Ian, from Synovus, that 65% of the chips they sell for server use are used in deep learning, are used in, you know, AI, generative language models. So it's really about AI, right? It's not just a fad. They haven't just slapped AI on the name. It really is being used, the bulk of their product, in this new technology.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are all kinds of stats floating around at the moment that add to this, and, you know, they're incredible. Another way to look at it would be, I saw another report that said NVIDIA currently has north of 80% market share in this particular segment. And guess what? During the last 3 months, 100% of the installs of this type of system were on NVIDIA equipment. So it's got a strong market share. And it's getting better. And now this is by far the company's largest source of revenue. I mean, Matt, you were talking about, well, why would you sell out the stock? Remember, last year and this year have been a terrible year for the company's overall earnings. It's in the PC business. That's horrible. That's why you sold out, not really knowing just how strong this AI surge could be. And now we're seeing it.
Well, we don't know, but Cathie Wood's supposed to know, right? She's the future guru. You know, she's the one who's making the big bets on these things that are going to happen later on in life.
Well, look at it this way. To be fair to her, right, NVIDIA gave a projection that was 53% higher than the average analyst estimate here.
So nobody got it right.
They embarrassed Wall Street, right? They embarrassed Wall Street, never mind one particular fund manager.
So I guess what I'm wondering is basically this ramp up where NVIDIA is benefiting, Ian, is this just as companies are exploring what they can do with AI, this version or this higher, you know, learning formula of AI, and they're trying to figure out how they basically benefit? Is that what this is, kind of an exploratory phase, in that we're not quite yet at the, hey, here's what really works and is going to pay off phase?
No, I think you're picking it as something which is really important and something which was a major topic on the conference call that they did yesterday. And that was like, look, hey, you're selling to Microsoft, you're selling to Google, you're selling to AWS. That's fantastic. But guess what? Those guys want to do their own chips. And if they're the only customers in town, sooner or later, they're going to find somebody else. So they won't need you as much. What are you going to do about it? And NVIDIA was like, you really haven't been listening to us. We believe that AI is going to be used everywhere, right? And in order for that to happen, here are these products that we've already put out there. They've done software for pharmaceuticals, software for all of the, you know, for automotive, for all of these different industries that wouldn't have these genius computer scientists who can then buy some of the service or even buy some of of NVIDIA's products and use AI for themselves. So, you know, they at least had an answer to a very, very important question about where this all goes,
Wait, so does that
how it
mean
plays.
they don't, and NVIDIA doesn't need a Microsoft or Google ultimately longer term because they can tap into all these other areas or
I
TBD?
mean, it's a,
Yeah.
it's a, how do they put it? A frenemy relationship right now.
Yeah.
Microsoft needs NVIDIA's chips. NVIDIA has put some of these services it's hoping to sell to these companies in the cloud hosted by Microsoft Azure or Amazon AWS. But down the road, in an ideal world, NVIDIA is going to be selling directly to some of these companies if they can acquire that kind of expertise or if NVIDIA can make it easy enough.
You know, Paul Sweeney, who in his former life was an investment banker, his immediate thought goes to taking advantage of this situation, right? If your stock pops like this and you are the it stock, I mean, right now, you want to own NVIDIA and you want to tell your friends that you own NVIDIA because you're the smart guy who's into AI. That could last a month, it could last 3 months, maybe it lasts a year, but probably not much longer. Are they going to raise capital? Are they going to buy something with these shares? Because they should really take advantage of this situation.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, knowing their CEO and knowing the way that they look at things, that's very much a throwback view of Silicon Valley and of, you know, the way that the markets work. They believe they're a technology company. They believe they have everything in place that they need. As you'll remember, they did try to buy Arm, and regulators around the world said, "Nope, you're too big. We don't like this." So they've learned that lesson. Why would they go off on
Good
something that
point.
they're probably not going to get? So that's probably the way they're looking at it.
So who competes with them ultimately?
Well, I mean, Intel, but investors don't believe them.
Holding back a
Look what
laugh.
happened to
Matt,
their.
can I just say, Matt and I, you know, Ian, going into this, we're like, did you look at Intel's market cap and did you look at Nvidia's market? Like, it's just hard to get my head around it.
No, and it's, I mean, AMD stock went up today, right? Because they do
Yeah.
similar things. They're nowhere near as far and advanced into this market as NVIDIA is. And in theory, Intel is there as well. Intel has been the heart of the data center for, you know, 20, 30 years. Investors just aren't buying that they have a way forward here. Even though Pat Gelsinger at Intel has been talking about his new products, his accelerators, data center products, and all of these things he's going to bring to market, investors just don't believe that right now.
Intel is worth less than an eighth. An eighth
Isn't that crazy? It's
of NVIDIA, right?
wild.
NVIDIA's trading right now, market
My
cap, 950 billion.
yeah,
Intel is
yeah.
115 million.
NVIDIA added more market cap today than Intel is worth in total.
Wow, that's a very strong point.
So 30 seconds left here. Come on, Ian, you've been following. I know I ask this all the time because your perspective is really valuable because you've studied this sector for so long. Does that make sense to you?
I mean, if you believe what Jensen Huang said, which is there are $1 trillion of data center equipment that needs to be replaced, right now they're in the lead. As to whether an absolute valuation makes sense in those terms, I don't know.
It's just interesting world we're living in. Ian, thank you. I know we go round and round a lot on this, but it seems to be the topic that everybody wants to talk about, either AI and or the chip sector. And you really just put it in such great perspective. Ian King, he is U.S. Semiconductor Networking Reporter at Bloomberg News on Zoom from San Francisco. Check out his work on the Bloomberg at Bloomberg.com and also on Twitter at Ian M. King. Pretty amazing stuff, huh?
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
All right, let's get to it because we want to talk a little bit about the cannabis industry. I don't know, Matt, if you saw, there was a Bloomberg News story earlier this month, and it, you know, it talked about cannabis basically facing financial and regulatory malaise in the U.S., but it isn't affecting the perceptions of consumers who increasingly approve of it.
I know. And the sales numbers are very strong. State by state, of course, is where we see that. But it's billions and billions of dollars in revenue. And that's runs the gamut from, you know, medical use, prescribed medical use, to
recreational,
like at a dead show.
All right. In the meantime, our next guest is in it, also has a personal story around it. We welcome Morgan Paxia, co-founder and managing partner of Poseidon Investment Management, keeper of the advisor shares, Poseidon,
like what? The king.
I know. It's not coming out right. Poseidon ETFs on Zoom in New York City. Sorry. It's been a rough week. Morgan, good to have you here with Matt and myself. First of all, tell us about how you got into all of this, because it is a personal story.
It is. Like so many of us that have gotten into the cannabis industry, usually starts for a lot of us with a family event. For us, we lost our parents to cancer at a very young age. I was 12 when my dad passed and 18 when my mom, and I started the business with my sister Emily just about 10 years ago now. But they were both believers in ending the war on drugs. They thought it was, you know, unjust. But really what was a clear moment for us was when our dad was in hospice care, a nurse actually offered him some cannabis, just trying to help him find some peace in the final days or just some comfort, you know, being on all those opioids. Wouldn't do it because the stigma, because it was illegal, didn't want to have any kind of tarnished kind of sentiment back with family or anybody around us. And obviously we thought that was very wrong. I was young, but as we say, it planted the seed for our future. And so we've been.
So you, Morgan, and your sister, Emily, what started this ETF? How did you get into it to begin with?
Our first fund we launched in January of 2014 it's actually a hedge fund. It still runs today, but we invested in much like a hybrid strategy where we were doing private early stage investments because everything was private and early back then, but had the ability to also invest in companies that were public or would become public companies. So it really gave us the full gamut. We launched our ETF in November of 2021, thinking that a lot of the bear market cycle had corrected. We were wrong. We were early with that. But also waiting patiently for the market to get a little bit more mature before we had a product such as an ETF. But we thought the ETF was a great addition to the Poseidon investment universe where we could have a product that anyone could buy. You know, as a hedge fund and our two subsequent venture capital funds, those are only eligible for accredited investors or, you know, institutional-like investors versus an ETF anyone can buy.
So how do you, I look at the price, right? And as you pointed out, you're early. So you came out at $10 and it's now down at $1.15. Yeah. And if I look at the holdings, you have Green Thumb, Curaleaf, Trulieve, Cresco. I mean, basically the usual suspects for the most part, right? Mm-hmm. And they all, their stock charts look the same as your ETF. What?
That's right.
What can you do differently than another fund or ETF that's investing in marijuana in order to get a little bit of alpha?
Yep, we're unconstrained, so we can invest globally. We can be, you know, in Canada or Europe. Really, there's not too much in Europe yet, but it is an unconstrained strategy from a whether or not we're investing in U.S. operators or technology companies. So that's one unique feature. We're not tied to any benchmark. It's really just at our discretion. And then we also have a dynamic leverage capability. So we can be anywhere from 80%, so we can be unlevered, or we can be up to 150% leverage. And we can dial that up and down. And as a good example, for the most part of this year, we were at 0.95 times. But then as some of this safe banking initiative started to come back with regular order in the Senate. There's some other things in the works. We have slowly taken leverage up to 110%. So we're just modestly leveraged today, but believing that there are some potential progress. So we saw regulatory change, but also the fundamentals of the industry have been improving over subsequent quarters. So we like that the fundamental support is there and any kind of regulatory progress would generate some nice upside return. But predominantly focused on good companies. We want to see companies that are you know, have gross margins, have, you know, nice EBITDA margins, have either the ability of generating free cash flow or are already generating free cash flow. And so that's what our portfolio looks like today. So really trying to focus on quality.
Right. Morgan, I feel like we've seen a lot of cycles already when it comes to the cannabis sector, to be fair. And is it just a case of the industry really can't get going until the Safe Banking Act is passed? I mean, they need to be part of the financial system.
Right.
It's been the one thing that's really been holding it
and
back.
Explain to us, if you could, it's the Secure and Fair Enforcement Banking Act. What is that going to allow you to do?
Well, the way we look at it is, it's first and foremost, it's helping small business in cannabis. It's providing safety to communities. We are largely a cash-based industry. So if you are a retailer, you have a lot of cash in your store, that's trouble, right? And we've seen a significant increase in crime around that, because there are people being advantageous. So that's
because you can't put it in banks, right?
You sort of can, but it's very limited. So yeah. Safe will help recognize that we are on the same playing field as every other industry, with the ability to deposit, wire, working lines of capital. So that will help. It also, if we do get capital markets included, which is being discussed, and the minority groups are actually supporting this, understanding that if you're going to have federal reform around banking, it should be all of banking. And we think that's actually a really smart way to think about it. We support that as well. We know the exchanges believe that too. And to your point, that we think that'll help move money again in this space. It's largely slowed down considerably. Custody is very hard. So banking reform is needed. And that's how DC functions. You know, the industry's moved far ahead, and now we're looking to DC to catch up with us on
DC
this first
functions,
step.
I would
this
be shocked. First step. I mean, what is your expectation for the
They're
Safe Banking Act?
A little busy
Act?
Right now.
I mean,
anyway,
the problem is it doesn't function, right? So, what's your expectation, Morgan, for Congress to actually move on this legislation?
It's actually looking like the Senate could get this done, as long as Safe stays in a pretty targeted way from a banking reform perspective. It sounds like we have Democrat and Republican support, and that's why it's going through this regular order process. And we think we could potentially see a vote as early as July. Then we have to move on to the House, which it's passed 7 times in the past, but we'll have to go through that process again. So that is helpful. But in the interim, we are seeing structures like one of the companies, TerrAscend, is potentially listing on the Toronto Stock Exchange. Now we might be seeing a structure that might actually be blessed by the NASDAQ, waiting on SEC. So if we're able to get access to the exchanges even without or while we are waiting for Safe Banking, that's progress. And our industry is finally done being stuck, you know, from a capital perspective, and very happy to see that action is moving again. And so capital will start to flow as a result of that.
All right, Morgan, thanks very much for joining us. Morgan Paxia there from Poseidon Asset Management. The ETF is the Advisor Shares Poseidon Dynamic Cannabis ETF, and the ticker is PSDN.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Bloomberg News reporting earlier this year how the fitness sector has roared back after being devastated by the pandemic. Cost pressures, though, and a possible recession could possibly pose a threat. So we thought we'd take a look, Matt, at the industry. And we've got someone who's actually spent more than 20 years managing, owning, and franchising health clubs. Chuck Runyon is co-founder and CEO at Anytime Fitness, a franchisor of gyms, joining us on Zoom from Woodbury, Minnesota. Chuck, also the CEO and co-founder of Self-Esteem Brands, which is the owner of Anytime Fitness and also the Bar Method and more. So he's certainly well-versed in this space. Hey, Chuck, nice to have you here with Matt and myself. Talk to us a little bit more about Anytime Fitness. How it all works and the type of growth you've seen, particularly post-pandemic.
Yes, Carol, Matt, thank you for having me from this beautiful day in Minnesota. Excited to be here. My partner and I started Anytime Fitness just over 20 years ago. We started in Minnesota, but today we serve over 5,500 communities in 40 countries around the world. And our goal has always been to make fitness more affordable, more accessible, and more effective. And we utilize technology to do that so members could work out on their schedule, not the gym schedule. And that technology is still in place today. And when you buy a membership at your local club, say in Minnesota, you get to use every club in the network. So we are still infused with technology. And now recently, we've just launched our coaching suite, which is providing people with education, motivation, anytime, anywhere. So whether they're in one of our gyms or studios or wherever in the world they live, we can now reach them, right? Help them be healthier, help them eat better, coach them to a better lifestyle. And so we're very excited and, you know, tremendous growth ahead. We are on a pathway to have 10,000 units by 2030.
So do you have, you know, a lot of people, myself included, have joined gyms and then like they'll go a few times and then never go again. And every, you know, couple of years I'll join another one and do it again, do it all over again. But I wish I could stick with it. How do you motivate someone like that?
It's a great question and something that has been going on in our industry since day one. And, you know, it comes down to a handful of things. First of all, personalization. You know, it really helps with understanding our members, where they're at in their life journey and where they want to get to. And once we do that, we can now not only give them the workout necessary, but give them the coaching, give them the motivation, give them the education that matters to them, and serve them up the type of content that they want to see. And so we're just in this for a series of small wins. If we can help our members just achieve some small wins, some progress along the way, right? When members see progress and experience it, they stick with their membership longer and they reach their fitness goals. When, like you said before, if they don't get that extra help, if they don't feel that level of personalization, they start to drift away, they leave the industry maybe to come back a few years later. So everything we do is about how do we help our members achieve progress, right? Our members' health is at the center of everything we build here.
You guys, though, believe that basically the government, right, should be, what, mandating fitness? Give us
yeah, let's get to that. That would be good.
Let's get a little bit into how you're thinking about this.
Yeah, well, let's zoom out again from our industry. And, you know, right now, globally, we spend $1 trillion a year on healthcare. And 70% of that spend is preventable based on something we call lifestyle medicine. Lifestyle medicine is proper eating, regular exercise, and better sleep and recovery. And so who better to deliver that than gyms or studios located in communities around the country? And so we were so disappointed that during COVID, health experts and policymakers around the world forced studios and gyms to shut down, which is the exact opposite message we should have, especially as we saw that COVID attacked people with underlying health conditions. They had it the worst. And so now,
to be fair, we didn't quite know how COVID was transmitted or how infectious it was, right? So as we found our way, like, it just made sense to shut it down initially.
I would argue there that there is empirical evidence. There is empirical evidence linking physical activity towards mental health and physical and social well-being. And guess what? Our industry was working with lawmakers to say, we can social distance people inside of our clubs and studios. We can only allow a certain amount of people in at certain times. We were trying to work with them to say, look, fitness is essential. And if it's outside the club or inside a club or studio, the message should be, let's keep people moving. Let's keep them healthy during COVID. Because now what's accelerated is we have issues of mental health. We have issues where people have been inactive. We have issues of loneliness, right? We have issues of weight gain. And right now, cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes and obesity are the number one killer globally.
Yeah, we have a big fat problem in this country, Chuck.
It was the wrong message to send.
So hold on. None of us are disputing these numbers, and no doubt about it. But this whole idea of government mandating fitness and wellness, I'm not saying I disagree.
It's not that they're mandating. He's not saying they should mandate fitness and wellness. He's saying they should consider it essential so that they wouldn't close it down in case of a pandemic.
Yeah, and I would not use the word mandating, but think about this. What health expert have you heard, like, really say, get behind, move more, eat better, sleep better? It was all about, like, avoiding a virus. But our real virus is inactivity, right? At the end of the day, we lose hundreds of thousands of people a year to preventable diseases that if they were just live healthier lifestyles, right, we could not only save money, but save lives. And so that should be the message coming out of COVID, is how do we get people healthier? And there's no better industry to deliver that than our gyms and studios. And so we're trying to educate policymakers and lawmakers to help with that.
I mean, hopefully we'll never get back to a pandemic where we shut down. I hope the government has learned lessons about these draconian procedures. But one thing we can do, Chuck, is encourage kids to be more active. When I was a child, and Carol, I'm sure as well, we had
Presidential Fitness.
Exactly. President Eisenhower
had to climb
started
ropes,
this thing, and it was like a big
push-ups.
Deal when I was a kid. And I think that kids today, for some reason in this like snowflake generation, they're allowed to skip gym class because it hurts their feelings. Like, don't we have to change that?
We do. In fact, if you look at most school budgets around the country, FIAD is being cut. And so there is less and less activity in our kids' lives. And technology is also playing a role to have our kids be more sedentary. So we absolutely, with both adults and children, need to create awareness and incentives and policies to shape the health of this country and to shape the health of global health.
Don't you think technology, though, ultimately with a Apple Watch and different things, though, are kind of getting us to a point where we're more aware of our fitness or lack thereof in just kind of about 25 seconds, real quick?
I think that the opportunity is there. We absolutely can enable technology for more activity, but it's also like having us be sedentary, right? We're sitting and having too much screen time. So it's both a strength.
No,
and a
but I'm saying, like, if I got a watch, Matt's got a watch, like, you count your steps. These things are potentially good. We'll continue this conversation at another date.
Chuck, I'm with you, Chuck.
No, I'm all for wellness and fitness. You know that. Co-founder, CEO of Anytime Fitness, joining us from Minnesota. This is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
It's the question that drives us. You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, we've got, about 18 minutes left in today's trading session. What did you do when I wasn't here? Do you do this?
Yeah, I hung out with Paul Sweeney, but neither of us knows how to run the show, so it was a little bit of a calamity.
I bet it was kind of
We're glad you're back.
I'm glad to be back. All right, so let's get to it. It is time for our Drive to the Close, and our guest on this, Thursday, yeah, Lauren Sanfilippo, Director and Senior Investment Strategy Analyst for the Chief Investment Office at Bank of America. She is joining us on the phone in New York City. Lauren, good to have you here. There's a lot of stuff going on. First of all, how do you guys think about the craze in AI right now? And how investable is it?
Yeah, I think it's been pretty interesting to see this play out just in terms of some of our thematic ideas, these longer term things that are playing out now in the markets. And sort of that mega cap surge, it's been well discussed on your program, but we're still sort of in this trading pattern of the top of the market, those top five stocks that are accounting for the majority of that S&P gain year to date. And obviously those valuations have obviously been running up along the way. But those mega cap names, and it's following this AI sort of euphoric surge in the market, it's sort of what's moving the index. And I don't think you need to read too much into this narrowness of the market, but we'll see how that AI story plays out as it pertains to productivity.
Not a play for you right now?
We do think it's also an up in quality story that's really important to us year to date. So we think those companies that are following the AI craze, they're still exhibiting those tech balance sheets are pretty healthy, and they've proved their earnings power through the Q1 earnings reports.
You say we shouldn't pay too much attention to the narrowness, to the lack of breadth. Why is that?
Yeah, so I think, in most cases it could indicate that, we'd prefer to see a broader rally, of course. That would be the preference. But I think, some of these companies will grow into the valuations as it can be attributed to the AI craze and other reasons why the index is moving.
Now, Lauren, that sounds very similar to the kind of things that Carol and I were hearing in 1999. And that's the last time we had such narrowness in this market. I mean, there's no breadth. If you look at the equal-weighted S&P, we're down year to date. So it's got to be concerning at some levels.
Or does it just mean there's more opportunity for the rest of the market to come on in?
Yeah, I think this is part of sort of that earnings reset that's still in front of us. And then that will include probably coming out the other side will include a broader rally, broader participation. But really, until then, yeah, the other names are in participation purgatory, right?
So is this part of the reason that you, well, Savita at Bank America, your strategists have raised your target? You're now looking at 4,300 for the year end, and you were only looking at 4,000 previously.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is attributable, too, to the largely better-than-fear first quarter earnings. I think the path forward, maybe next quarter, it brings a trough in earnings, the upcoming second quarter reporting season. I think we're in the thick of that earnings recession, though, that I was talking about, and then we see those efficiencies for corporate America sort of
reset.
Wait.
Are we in an earnings recession, you're saying? Or because I know we've talked with our Gina Martin Adams a lot about it, and she said it's already happened.
Yeah, that's correct. So we did hit the second quarter of that negative earnings report. And, you know, Savita's penciling in now the second quarter also negative, the third quarter also negative. So we're sort of in the thick of it. That's right.
So what kind of recovery do you expect in terms of earnings? And what's going to drive that? Is it all going to come from AI?
No, so it's not going to all come from AI. I do think that sort of tech took it on the chin last year, right? So they've already been working on sort of making those efficiency, cost cutting. Tech's sort of already been in this. I think the rest of the market sort of gets pulled along here.
So upbeat, pessimistic, optimistic? What are you in terms of the financial markets right now?
Yeah, I think I'm more positive after seeing first quarter play out in terms of earnings. But, you know, I think if you then segment the actual economy, right, we've seen that leading economic indicator. It's now confirmed that, you know, it's dropped for the 13th consecutive month. So the worst of the slowdown, if it materializes into a recession, it's actually in front of us. So our economists are calling for that recession beginning in Q3 of this year. So I think, you know, somewhere in the throes here, we've gotten more positive, yes, but that growth slowdown still in front of us and that earnings recession is still, the majority of it's still in front of us as well.
So what do you expect the Fed to do, and how important is, you know, Jay Powell's decision on rates going forward?
Yeah, I mean, is it a pause? Is it a skip? It's almost like a weird game of Uno. And there's a lot of terms being thrown out there and what they decide to do at the June meeting. I think by the time the Fed puts all the pieces together, staying data dependent, you know, our view is the June meeting will bring a pause. Maybe that's, we already saw the last hike to the Fed's interest rate hiking cycle. It was in May. And market expectations have sort of been bouncing around here. At one point, cuts were expected for June, and those cuts are now being pushed out to later in the year. And we're more of the mindset that cuts aren't a story until next year. It would be more typical anyway to see that sort of pause, that length of pause. I think the average is around 10 months between the last rate hike and the first cut of the cycle. So as is typical, we expect to sort of hold that pause for some time.
Hey, Lauren, just last question. I mean, when you're getting together with your team and just talking about the markets and what's going on, what is the thing you guys spend the most time talking about? Is it valuations? Is it Fed policy? Is it action now or lack thereof out of D.C.? What is it?
Yeah, I think it's actually a mixture of all those things right now. But it's also about investment areas, right? How we came into the year hedging for the recession, and now we have to think about the pivot forward, right? So, like, where are there investable sleeves in the market? And, you know, we've been defensively positioned, but, you know, with so much money on the sidelines, I'd caution the market is up, what, 7-8% for the year, and we're just focusing on staying invested and staying diversified.
Where's all the money on the sidelines? Money market funds?
Yeah, that's a lot of money, right? A lot of money committed to money market funds this year. And, you know, yeah, we're just looking for opportunities to put money to work.
That's interesting. So once everybody comes back in. Huh. Lauren, thanks so much. Lauren Sanfilippo, Director and Senior Investment Strategy Analyst for the Chief Investment Office over at Bank of America on the phone.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.